Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
It's Friday and it's been snowing here in Bonn, Germany. Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. Let's jump straight to what we've lined up for you today, beginning with this breaking story. At least 14 UN peacekeepers have been killed by suspected rebels in an attack on their base in Congo's North Kivu region.
And also coming up, Liberians are now ready for the second round of voting after the Supreme Court throws out a petition challenging the October 10th presidential election results.
We all are wishing and waiting for the announcement of the date when the election will take place.
For the sake of peace, I feel happy about it because we all want peace in Liberia.
Mali tries to polish its image in order to attract major investment after years of jihadist attacks and separatist calls.
Alors, il y a quatre thèmes prioritaires.
We have chosen four areas in our national investment strategy: agriculture, animal husbandry, energy, and infrastructure.
All these stories plus your reactions on social media to the stories we're covering right here on Africa Link. But first, let's listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Kai Dombach with the DW News. The United Nations peacekeeping chief said he was outraged after at least 14 peacekeepers were killed in an overnight attack in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Jean-Pierre Lacroix tweeted that the attack occurred in the North Kivu province. Medical evacuations are ongoing. This is the worst attack on UN peacekeepers in recent history. Senegal opened a new airport on Thursday that will serve its capital city. It was named after Blaise Diagne, the first black African to be elected to the French Chamber of Deputies, who also served as the mayor of Dakar. The airport took over 10 years to build and cost $575 million. The government hopes it will bring an economic boost to the region. At least 60 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in South Sudan during battles over livestock. Cattle rustling and tit-for-tat violent raids are common in the area of the Western Lakes northwest of the capital Juba. Women are often raped and children abducted, but the attacks have gotten worse over the last 4 years since the civil war broke out in the region. Protests continued throughout the Palestinian territories and Middle East on Friday after U.S. President Donald Trump announced he would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. A Palestinian man was shot dead by Israeli soldiers near the Gaza border on Friday in the wake of the protests. The Israeli military said there were hundreds of Palestinians rolling burning tires and throwing rocks at police during the protest. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. The United Kingdom and European Union struck a deal on the first stage of terms of the UK's exit from the Union, known as Brexit. The UK is still expected to honor its financial obligations, which vary between $53 and $65 billion. The UK Prime Minister Theresa May is looking forward to the next step in the process. A convicted Dutch arms dealer was arrested in South Africa in the early hours of Friday morning. The Dutch authorities are now demanding the extradition of Huis Koevenhoven for his part in Liberia's bloody civil war. They are calling for him to serve a 19-year sentence for supplying weapons to former Liberian leader and warlord Charles Taylor in return for preferential treatment for his logging business. The two back-to-back civil wars between 1989 and 2003 ended up killing more than 250,000 people. Taylor also backed wars in neighboring Sierra Leone, which claimed at least 120,000 lives. And the Social Democrats have agreed to start talks of reforming a grand coalition with German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats and sister party, the Christian Socialists. The left-center party overwhelmingly voted to enter talks on Thursday evening. SPD parliamentary group leader Andrea Nahles said grand coalition talks would begin next Wednesday. The discussion comes after earlier talks between Merkel's conservative bloc and the Free Democrats and the Greens fell apart. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
You are listening to DW's African Link program, coming to you straight from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. We are live on Facebook as well, so do let us know your thoughts on the stories we're covering or any others that you might want us to cover. The green light has been switched on in Monrovia. Liberians are about to gear up for the presidential runoff election pitting former football star George Weah against Vice President Joseph Boakai. This comes after the country's Supreme Court ordered the Electoral Commission to proceed with the vote delayed for a month because of fraud complaints. As Evelyn Pade reports from Monrovia, the top court has called for a full audit of the voter registry, among other recommendations.
The court's final judgment on the election petition has been met with mixed reactions in the country's capital, Monrovia.
Well, I'm 100% prepared for this runoff election. We all are wishing and waiting for the announcement of the date when the election will take place.
For the sake of peace, I feel happy about it because we all want peace in Liberia. We want to elect a president. Today or tomorrow, we'll be able to give an account of the country's resources.
I'll satisfy with the decision what the court came away. I'm prepared for the runoff. I'm prepared. Anytime, I'm prepared.
The ruling Unity Party and opposition Liberty Party have alleged irregularities and fraud tinted the results of the first round of voting on October 10 and called for a total rerun of the election. Auguste Gafuan is the current campaign chair of the ruling Unity Party. This is how he feels about the court's ruling.
The Supreme Court has admitted to a cleanup, and we need to find out. And we have proved the magnitude of the problem. So we need now to discuss the milestones that must be met in order to ensure that those cleanups are done.
The 4-1 court ruling put an end to weeks of tension, but with no date set for the runoff and a planned May-January transition drawing ever closer, much remains up in the air. Nevertheless, Madam Yvette Chesinwe, the head of the Women's Election Situation Room, said the ruling has brought a huge sigh of relief to the country.
The message is the Supreme Court has spoken. Whether we agree or disagree, it doesn't matter. What matters is the final decision of the Supreme Court.
Battled by back-to-back civil war between 1989 and 2003 and an Ebola crisis that killed thousands from 2014 to 2016, Liberia's presidential election is considered a crucial test of the West African nation's stability and will be the first democratic transition of power in 7 decades.
Evelyn Pade reporting from Monrovia. And Isaac, it's quite encouraging that during this 1 month where the country was in limbo, not knowing whether the vote will be cancelled or not, there has not been a single incident of violence. It's quite encouraging.
Exactly, Crispin, just like you said. And it's a story we've been, you know, watching closely. And our correspondent, Evelyn Pade, I think, you know, she's looking forward to giving us more stories, you know, about what happened in the next coming days. Isn't it?
That's very right.
Anyway, demonstrations have been held around the world as anger intensifies over U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel. In Bethlehem, police fired tear gas at people who gathered after Friday prayers to protest the U.S. decision. Israel's government has stepped up security in the country after Palestinian groups called for a day of rage. Now, DW's Leila Harak spoke to our correspondent Tanya Kramer, who's on the ground in Jerusalem, to find out more on what happened today. Take a listen.
We saw after Friday prayers, people came out here where I'm standing from prayer services out of Damascus Gate, which is one of the main gates to the Old City in East Jerusalem. There were protests, there were singing and sometimes also praying again. And then police and riot police and special forces moved in and trying to push people out. Then they came back. It was back and forth also. They tried to push people out with horses. So it was a bit back and forth. But right now, what we're seeing, there is still a high police presence, but that's always here in East Jerusalem, and especially at this point here in town. And people are going back normally into the city here at Damascus Gate, and, you know, they're walking around. It is less tense than probably as expected.
We've seen protests break out in Turkey, Jordan, and other nations. Any word from the Israeli leadership what they are planning to do next?
No, we didn't hear much reaction to those protests. I mean, what we heard actually the day before is that Mr. Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, that he is quite confident that also other countries would follow the lead of the U.S. To maybe move also their embassies. I mean, he's very pleased with this decision, and we don't really see that they take into account, you know, all this criticism coming from all over the world. So there were no, reactions to that yet on what's happening on the ground in other Arab countries.
That was DW's Leila Harak speaking to our own Tanya Kremer in Jerusalem.
And now back to Africa, where the first International Investment Forum in Mali opened this week with over 500 delegates from Africa, Asia, Europe and beyond. The meeting in Bamako to drum up support for business opportunities in the country that has been largely devastated by conflict and militants, especially in the north. But will this forum manage to attract the foreign direct investment Mali desperately needs? Bram Posthumus reports from Bamako.
C'est le lieu et l'occasion pour moi de saluer et remercier le patronat malien.
The president himself came to this multi-star hotel in downtown Bamako to officially open the very first international investment forum for Mali. I want a strong private sector, he said, one that powers economic growth and creates thousands of jobs, especially for young Malians. At the heart of the event, questions. How can we make Mali's agriculture sector competitive? How can we export more of our products? What's the solution to the endless electricity problems? And on a more positive note, how do we use clever technology to build tomorrow's infrastructure? Mali is looking for investment in four specific areas, as Awa Bagayoko explains. She's an investment promotion officer at Mali's government investment agency, the forum's organizer.
Alors, il y a quatre thèmes prioritaires.
We have chosen four areas in our national investment strategy: agriculture, animal husbandry, energy, and infrastructure. We then added information technology because we believe that development happens faster and more smoothly with these new technologies.
Plus rapidement et plus naturellement par les nouvelles technologies.
These choices make a lot of sense. Mali needs to up its entrepreneurial game in all these areas. The prominent national businessman Cyril Ashkar told his audience what that means. Make credit available to those who need it, get Malians to buy Malian products because they seem to think that foreign is best, put an end to corrupt smuggling practices that kill our business, and develop the political will to help our entrepreneurs, male and female. Well, President Keita's presence here may be proving a game changer in that respect.
Bienvenue à Bamako. Sous le haut patronage de son excellence, Monsieur Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, président de la République, chef de l'État.
And that report was compiled by Bram Posthumus in Bamako.
Well, it's a positive step for Mali to be hosting an international investment conference in Bamako, especially about the attacks, recent attacks in the north and all those groups. Crispin, there are some people commenting on this story. Mungai Gachunu says, African problems should only be handled by Africans. International community as a term has been synonymous with Europe and her cronies. Every time they're in the picture in conflict zones, the problem miraculously exacerbates.
And Prince Akere Divine says all foreign troops must leave Mali fast. Can Europe lay off Africa for a minute? Maybe we could just sort ourselves out.
Frederick from Nigeria says Mali standing on its feet is a mirage so far as they remain in the French yoke. Who are the jihadists, a French terrorist group through which France wants to maintain their presence and exploitation of African resources. Point to ponder there.
And then Kimi Sangwe says the international community can't and will never help any African country to stand nor be stable. Thus, I don't see anything good coming from them that will benefit Mali. Instead, they will turn to enslave them and in the name of giving them loans and foreign aid.
Many thanks for those comments. And I'd like to welcome all our French Facebook users following us live on air. And Crispin, let's go a little bit to Tanzania, where a journalist who was reported missing after a string of murders of officials and police say he has been missing for the past 2 weeks. We have someone commenting on our Facebook page who says, DW, we need your intensive investigation in Tanzania about human rights violation. I don't know whether this is our role, really. All you can, I think, is to report. And anyway, he says, we are living with full of doubts, no right to ask about government responsibility.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of concern about Tanzania with President Magufuli really cracking down on the media and opposition and critics. We just covered yesterday a number of lawmakers were also arrested. So I think there's a bit of concern as to what kind of leadership he is imposing in Tanzania. And there are some people who are a bit worried about that.
Well, all we can say to our follower, we can only do the reporting and we leave the rest to the authorities that are responsible for that.
All right. Keep it Africa Link.
In case you've just joined us, this is DW's Africa Link program. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Ugandan women are demanding their husbands act more responsibly by escorting them to prenatal, antenatal and postnatal checkups.
You know, men of these days are very complicated. He pregnants you, but going to the hospital, you go there alone. These nurses, they always ask questions, where is your husband?
And in sports, Portugal and Real Madrid's Cristiano Ronaldo was awarded the Ballon d'Or for World Player of the Year for a joint record fifth time, going level with rival and Barcelona forward Lionel Messi.
That's fascinating, Crispin, isn't it? But before we tell you more about Ronaldo and his latest achievement, we head to a country which you might not have associated with big spenders with cash to burn. But it seems people in Malawi are literally throwing cash around. The country's Central Reserve Bank calculates it could be losing at least $500,000 annually because of having to replace damaged or worn-out currency. Much of the currency is damaged during wedding ceremonies and parties when partygoers become overexcited and throw cash at the newlyweds. It is against that background that the central bank has rolled out a campaign to discourage Malawians from the growing trend of throwing their cash around. And from Lilongwe, Miriam Kaliza sent this report.
This is not your typical wedding ceremony, because apart from eating, drinking, and congratulating the newlyweds, these people are committing a currency mutilation activity. Malawians have a tradition of throwing money on the floor as a sign of wealth and happiness during weddings, bridal showers, and other social events. Unfortunately, the money thrown on the floor is trampled upon and in most cases damaged. According to the Reserve Bank of Malawi Governor Dali Tsokabambe, this malpractice is costly.
It costs the Reserve Bank of Malawi about 12 to 13 billion Malawi kwacha every year in order for us to destroy those damaged notes and replace them with a new one. So it's a serious cost to the country and the economy.
According to the word in the streets, the blame goes back to the Reserve Bank. Many people accuse the central bank for printing banknotes that are not as durable like in other countries. One Lilongwe resident, Nshindimeki, says though the Reserve Bank has a point, it will not be easy to stop the practice.
I would rather suggest that they should keep on doing the sensitizations that might bear fruits in the long run.
Central Bank Governor Kabambe says they will start campaigns to educate people not to mutilate Malawian banknotes. He also threatens to start prosecuting culprits from 2018.
We'll go on a massive campaign to educate and inform the nation that it is an offence for us to continue defacing Malawi's notes. And indeed, next year, if this continues, we will endeavour to take that step to prosecute all those that would deface the country's currency as per our laws.
The Reserve Bank of Malawi has set aside 500 million kwacha, over $600,000 for the campaign.
Miriam Kaliza reporting from Lilongwe.
Now, in Uganda, it has become government policy that pregnant women should be accompanied to antenatal appointments by their husbands or partners. But despite this edict, many expectant mothers continue to visit health facilities alone because of their husbands' lack of commitment. At many health centres, pregnant women who turn up alone have been pushed to the back of queues. Giving priority to couples is a way of encouraging them to convince their husbands to join them on their next visit. That treatment has led some pregnant mothers to go the extra step of hiring men to act as their husbands to enable them access antenatal services. From Kampala, Frank Yiga sent this report.
Bella Kasigairi is 4 months pregnant and often uses a bicycle as a means of transport to reach Kaolo Hospital in Buikwe District for antenatal checkups. She tells me her husband has never stepped foot at the hospital to attend antenatal services for all her children.
You know, men of these days are very complicated. He pregnants you, but going to the hospital, you go there alone. These nurses, they always ask questions, where is your husband? So for me, I just get a border man, and we plan what they are going to ask him, and exactly that's what he answers. It is very risky to go with someone who is not your husband, but what can you do?
Scholastic Namudu is a maternal health care service provider with Reproductive Health Uganda. She tells me men, especially in rural areas, have always abandoned their responsibilities during prenatal, antenatal, and postnatal.
If you impregnate a woman, it should be your responsibility to take care of your wife. From the time there is conception, you need the care. Of course, socially, emotionally, economically, financially, physically, she needs you. So in the process, that woman will be depressed.
Due to economic hardships, Victor Chwolavye, a father of two, says he has little time to go with his wife for antenatal care services as required of him. The least he can do, he says, is to drive her to hospital.
The problem is, when I go to the hospital, the lines are long, and I have little time. I have to go and look for money. I drop her, then go and look for money. Secondly, people in the hospitals, they want money also, because when she delivers, I'll have to have money. So that time of waiting in the hospital, I feel I want to be there, but I have to go and look for money.
The lack of participation by men is affecting efforts for maternal newborn health management in Uganda. Vivian Nakalika, the spokesperson, Minister of Health, says that the government has devised measures to address challenges in reproductive health.
As the Ministry of Health, we've devised means to engage men. We go down to the grassroots, we go to communities, we work with village health teams and local council authorities to make sure that this message sinks down to the lowest levels of community.
And that report was compiled by Frank Yiga in Kampala.
Now, Crispin, we have some comments coming in about the Malawi story of throwing cash at parties and ceremonies.
And people are trampling on it.
Exactly. Now, Ndage Etsen says, simple, they stop throwing banknotes and start using coins because it's their tradition. Anyway.
I'm not sure whether they will like this idea because they want to show off their wealth. So
they want
coins,
to show the figures
exactly,
on those notes.
The bigger the currency, the better. John Ayub Shagaya says, it's a popular practice in many parts of Africa and it's not a show of wealth. Money is thrown on the ground to allow the couples to march on it as a demonstration of their status and dignity. Also, it is a way of wishing them luck and prosperity.
Phileas from Malawi says the culture is good, but what is needed is the way of doing it. Instead of throwing money on the ground, must have a bucket of throwing in money to make sure that money is taken good care of.
Okay. Lamin Fadera says it's a tradition not to be practiced. Money is worth all due respect.
And Akoson Raymond from Southern Cameroon says the practice is even rampant in West Africa, Nigeria and the Cameroon. To help out with this, during these ceremonies, a basket could be placed nearby for money to be dropped inside. It is almost impossible to completely stop it. Mm.
Another interesting one from Percy from Southern Cameroon. He says, only in Africa will you find such a tradition where people die of hunger next door and they trample on money. My Africa needs a revival. Change is coming.
Many thanks for those comments and be back right after this.
Blog Report.
And for our blog report this week, we bring you Laura Reinders, a travel blogger from Namibia. She started her blog about 8 years ago to show off what Namibia has to offer travelers, both young and old. As an avid traveler herself, her blog, Living Through Lens, says, captures idyllic destinations for visitors. She says her love for photography was inspired by her late father, who was a tour guide in Namibia. Anna Selkius caught up with her in Namibia and in Windhoek, and, you know, take a listen to what they had to discuss.
Well, my father, he passed away 9 years ago, but he was a tour operator and also an avid travel photographer. So I've been around a camera, like, since I can remember, and I just really love to capture moments that either people don't notice or that they would like to keep forever. So that is the big inspiration for me to do photography.
Has your work had any impact on society or on people?
Well, I like to think so. I came back about 5 years ago from Thailand. And since then, a lot of friends and people I know came to me and said that I inspired them with my passion, doing my own thing, running a couple of businesses. And with the photography, I really did quite well in the last couple of years. I started quick and it boomed very quickly. So I know of quite a few people that got into photography, you know, looking through my pages and going through my stuff, and also to travel. I think to travel is to live, and lots of young people here in Namibia have been traveling since I, you know, really started chatting to them a bit.
Back to your blog, Living Through Lenses. What have been the rewards of blogging? How long have you been blogging, and what have the challenges been?
Well, the challenge for me mostly is time, because I'm a full-time wedding photographer. I don't always get the time to write, and I've got a notebook full of stories and ideas that I really want to put into words and post on the blog. And then also, a bit, Namibians aren't really into blog reading, so I found it hard to just attract them to my site or to my Facebook page and have them read my stories. So I try to keep the articles also quite short, post more pictures, and just, you know, a couple of paragraphs here and there to attract more people, because no one has time to just read and read and read. So I found that a very big challenge.
And the rewards?
The rewards is that I found, I met a lot of people in the industry. I worked with the Namibian Tourism Board a couple of years ago, where we went on an amazing trip with some other bloggers from all over the world. And we went around the country seeing spectacular sights and doing really cool activities.
Lorica Renders, a travel blogger from Namibia.
To sports now, and CR7 has done it again. Cristiano Ronaldo has won the Ballon d'Or for the fifth time. Ronaldo left his arch rival Lionel Messi in the call for the second year running by clinching the top footballer award. How did he manage that? DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold explains.
Well, he just had another great year. He really produces the goods, and he did again last year. He had 42 goals in all competitions last season, 15 in World Cup qualifying for Portugal, 25 in La Liga, and really performed well in the Champions League, getting 12 goals in last season's Champions League, including two in the 4-1 win over Juventus in the final. So hard to argue with him as this year's Ballon d'Or winner.
What about the other players? You know, we look at Neymar or Griezmann. Do they stand any chance to break into this dominance of Messi and Ronaldo?
Not so fast. I don't know. I think there may be sort of a changing of the guard in this respect, because Ronaldo's 32, Messi is 30, and Griezmann and Neymar are a little bit younger. Griezmann's 26, Neymar's 25. I think probably Neymar is a better bet to win it. Interesting, the Real Madrid president came out and said to Neymar, hey, you know, if you want to win the Ballon d'Or, come to Real Madrid and you can win it here.
Now let's move to the Bundesliga. We have a game coming up tomorrow on Saturday. Bayern Munich, the league leaders, are meeting Eintracht Frankfurt. What's your take on that game?
I think it's going to be pretty tough for Eintracht Frankfurt. They've had a pretty good season. They're in eighth position, better than I thought. I thought they were going to have a really tough season this year. They had a particularly surprisingly good season last year, and I thought they were going to have a bit of a letdown this year, but they're doing pretty well. But since Jupp Heynckes took over as Bayern Munich coach, they've really been firing on all cylinders, and they had that loss against Borussia Mönchengladbach, but I think it's Bayern should have no real problem in Frankfurt. I hate to say that. I sort of like Frankfurt, but...
All right. Now, let's move on to Philipp Lahm. He's been named honorary captain of Germany. How much, you know, of an honor is that to get this award?
Yeah, it is a pretty big honor. He's only the sixth guy to get that, and it's all only captains, only ex-captains, I guess, that get it. The previous ones were Fritz Walter, of course, led Germany to the 1954, West Germany, I should say, to the 1954 World Cup. Then there was Uwe Seeler, Franz Beckenbauer, Lothar Matthäus. I think it was just last year Jürgen Klinsmann got it, and now Philipp Lahm. So a really nice honor. Not that many people get it. The interesting thing is what Joachim Löw said in the ceremony today. He said there should actually be an award not just for player of the year, but player of the decade for everything that he has achieved in his career. So quite you know, glowing words from the still national team coach. And of course, he was the captain of the team that won the 2014 World Cup.
DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold.
Ah, you heard it all. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo did it again. You know, he gave Messi the run of his money.
Yeah. A lot of people don't like Cristiano Ronaldo, but I think he's also very confident. He's somebody who just succeeded out of sheer hard work.
Exactly. Puts so much effort in what he does, especially when he goes to take spot kicks.
That's true. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. And for all our Facebook users, Keep It Africa link, DW Africa. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe.
and we wish you a very nice weekend.